The Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose. Today, we have an amazing guest here. We have Scott Glassman, psychologist and author and amazing man who's going to talk to us about happiness and why he chose to write a book all about happiness. Scott, so great to be with you. Thank you for joining me today.
Julie, it's great to be with you and to be able to talk to your viewers about happiness. It's an area that I'm so passionate about and helping people discover their best possible selves and pathways to get there.
And talk about growing up. Did you ever imagine that you would end up writing a book about happiness?
So I didn't think the book would be about happiness, but ever since I can remember, I've always loved to write. And I would write fiction and poetry, and I dreamed one day that I could have a book that could reach many, many people. And it just so happened that, you know, when I was younger, you know, as we all do, encountering some really difficult times and going through some social, emotional struggles and adversity was actually the pivot point to eventually writing a book and helping people through psychology and through positive psychology and talking about happiness versus the more creative side of what I was doing. Not to say that writing about happiness isn't creative, because this whole project has been one fantastic gift of creation. But certainly it began, as I think we all do growing up, facing challenges. Mine revolved around being rejected and bullying in middle school and struggling with depression and living in a house where my father, who's a physician, you know, kind of created this very loving man, but created an environment of high control, high demand, where always being focused on outcomes and how did you perform versus who you were. And so what I learned as a kid, and as I think many of us do who live in similar types of environments or experience adversity, is that loving myself was contingent on approval of others and performance, rather than intrinsically being who I was and valuing myself for who I was. And that's something that I had to learn progressively over the years through help and getting to the place where I could be of help to others.
Absolutely. And so many of us are looking for that external validation, right? We come in to the world and we are just us. And then by about age 10, we are wanting to please our parents and our friends. And by teenagers, we just want to fit in. And you mentioned that you suffered bullying and a lot of difficulty through your middle school, maybe high school years. Talk about, at what point was there a specific moment when you decided, like, instead of being a victim of my circumstance, I'm going to decide to be a psychologist and help others? What was that journey for you?
Yeah, I think it was first asking for help and being open to help, professional help. And I've worked as a kid with many really good therapists, and I really began to value myself intrinsically and begin to see my strengths and to begin to reshape these ideas, which were kind of misunderstandings of who I was, into a way that I could generate my own sense of well-being internally without having to rely on what was happening outside of me. So that was the first step. And I think the second step for me was in college, majoring in psychology, finding a love for a discipline, science, that was all about helping other people find their best possible selves, recover from difficult times, strive and succeed through adversity. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I worked with Dr. Martin Seligman, who was widely considered the principal founder of the field of positive psychology. This was in the late 90s. And that was just really incredible, because I got to teach resilience to middle school students in West Philadelphia. And so that really ignited my passion for how can we develop a set of skills, cognitive behavioral skills, that can be like the engine of feeling good, and that we can have control over, that we can feel effective, and that we can see our best strengths. So those were the two major pivot points for me. And sometimes we got to look back at our adversity and thank it, right? Yeah. For steering us into, something that we may never have imagined for ourselves.
Absolutely. I love that you shared those two points, and I want to touch on both of them. So the first point you mentioned was that you had the privilege and the opportunity to meet with different psychologists over the years when you were younger. And number one, I just want to say congratulations to you for having that open heart and the desire to learn and understand and to ask for help. I have two teenagers and a preteen, and I see that can be really difficult. And but my question to you is, in doing that for my own kids and in trying to help them find the right psychologist, it's been a tough journey. It's not always easy to find the right match and somebody who can speak to them in a way that they respect and understand and that they're open to. So, and in becoming a psychologist, what did you find to be the best tool to really engage and connect with your clients?
I think it goes to this idea of what's called unconditional positive regard. That's where you walk into a session with somebody you really may not know at all. And right off the bat, they are curious about you. They are valuing and they are non-judgmental. And I think it's really those skills and those attributes of who that person is that will help create an environment of safety, comfort, and trust. And so you can feel okay opening up and being vulnerable because you know that you're not going to be judged or pressured to make changes that you may not feel ready to make. So that autonomy support, the support of choice within that relationship, also is a hugely important factor that I would encourage all, parents, if you're taking your kids to a therapist, to look for those qualities. And when they come out of the session, asking them, what was it like? What did you feel comfortable talking about? And why?
I love that. I love your points there and the importance of especially for teens, but really for anybody, is they want to be heard and understood, and that curiosity, that genuine presence, right?
Absolutely.
Are there ever sessions that you're in when you notice that you're sort of like somewhere else and you have to come back? And how do you get yourself there?
Well, that speaks to mindfulness, and I am an avid mindfulness practitioner. It forms the basis of my book, A Happier You. It's the very first week where we're helping people to shift the spotlight of their attention. If it has wandered to maybe something that's counterproductive or ruminative thinking or a past trauma, which is no longer, like, you've maybe been there a lot of times and you're kind of tired of being in that space, to shifting into what it is in the present moment, which is maybe a more positive attribute about yourself or something good that has happened to you in the past hour or something good in that you're looking forward to. That is a really important shift. And in terms of in therapy, when I'm conducting therapy or in any kind of environment, just noticing if my mind has wandered, gently bringing it back. And we can do that 100 times, 1,000 times if we need to. We can always come back to center.
Right. So it's really being so present that you can even notice when you're going somewhere else in your mind. So important.
Without judgment, right?
Yes.
Because that we've wandered.
Judgment creates the resistance, and then you're down on yourself, and then you're spiraling, and then you're really not present.
Yeah, and that speaks to Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness. Jon Kabat-Zinn is one of the primary transporters of Eastern philosophy in terms of mindfulness and meditation into the West from the 70s. And he defines mindfulness as paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. to whatever is unfolding, you know, moment by moment.
Right.
And so I really love that concept. And I think the more that just in general, that in our society, that we can become mindful, mm-hmm. we can begin to notice in a compassionate way, in a caring way, without needing to automatically need that knee-jerk response to react. It right. sets us up to make very intentional, positive choices for our health, for our emotional well-being, for our social lives, for our entire environment, our society.
Absolutely. You also touched on the second point, which was that you had the opportunity in college to work with middle schoolers on resilience, which is so key to all middle schoolers who are going through so many changes within their bodies and their friendships and school becoming more stressful and the stakes being high. What did you find that you were able to connect? Like, what was that passion within you that then you were able to share with those middle schoolers to show them how important that resilience piece was and how they could find it within themselves?
Yeah, so we were following a very specific protocol. But what I loved about what we were doing is teaching them the difference between a thought and a feeling, and then how that relates to choices in their lives. And I think that sounds pretty basic, but it's really an incredibly powerful approach to beginning to feel more control over what's happening inside of you and also outside in your environment based on your choices. So if we can identify a thought is not a fact, and that's one of the things that we were teaching them in really interesting ways that were appropriate for mm-hmm. middle school students, with thought bubbles and kind of cartoons and, you know, helping them understand that everything that they might be thinking may not be necessarily accurate. And then maybe there's some thoughts which were, you know, counterproductive that they might want to challenge. Right. And that might, if they challenge that thought, like, let's say, you know, I have no friends, might be a thought in that thought bubble. Looking for the evidence against that thought, you know, is that really true that you have no friends? And that when they come up with the evidence that, well, no, there's a lot of people who want to spend time with me, then the feeling that results is different. Mm-hmm. Instead of sadness and feeling alienated, lovely. There's a feeling of connectedness and positive self-esteem, you know, self-worth. So that transformation, and I'm passionate about that because that approach is the one that I've been trained in as a psychologist. It's the one that I felt helped me personally the most as I moved through my challenges in life. Right. And it's now the one that I've embodied in a framework of positive psychology and a happier you. So you see these, all of the pieces of your life seem to kind of connect in very coherent ways. And that's a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose that is so valuable.
Yes. In writing the book, what came up for you that you didn't expect? I know that you have studied this for a long time. You're very passionate about this work and about really helping others, supporting others through their journey so they don't experience some of the things that you've gone through. You know, in all, did you learn in writing the book that surprised you?
I think it began to reinforce rather the importance of practice, because I had been running the program A Happier You for about 3 or 4 years before beginning to write the book. And we go through each of the themes, each of the 7 weeks with our participants. But sitting down and really intensely focusing on, if I were not in this program, in this group with other people being guided by a facilitator, what would be the most helpful for me to practice accessing gratitude, which is our week 3 focus in the book, as well as the program. And it was by looking at my own practices and the practices that we teach in the program and breaking them down step by step and really seeing, you know, a lot of self-help out there is a little bit ambiguous at times and maybe not as applied or practical. I really wanted kind of what do you do step one when, let's say you want to practice gratitude. What do you do at step two? You know, how do you expand that experience in step three? And so as I wrote, I was also experiencing the exercises myself, and it was reinforcing the importance, the consistency, and the depth as being really important variables in how we are able to help ourselves. Because if you don't have consistency, if you're kind of superficial about it, and you don't really, you're not kind of broad in your scope, you're not trying different things, it's not going to be as effective. So that was probably the biggest lesson.
I love that. And what really makes this book, which I guess, you can't see because it's yellow, Happier You. What makes it so special is that you really have been in a practice of it yourself. Yeah. And you developed the program and you had many participants before you wrote the book. So the book came with so much experience, real experience, as well as your own personal journey, which is felt in the book that, you know, there's like a genuineness and an authenticity there that you can see what's going on. You can feel you through the book, and the steps will be helpful because they've been proven by you and other participants that you've had. So that's just incredible.
I'm really grateful that came through, because one of my goals was to write it with the voice of deep compassion, caring, consideration, and non-pressure, no judgment, as if I was sitting in a session with you, whoever is reading, and gently guiding them down this path. And so I'm really happy that came through. And the other surprise for me as I wrote the book was getting the contributions from some of the participants in the program and who've worked with these exercises, and seeing how it impacted their lives, how it changed their entire days, the way they see the world, their mindsets moving from more negativity and, encompassed into positive leaning. So that was really wonderful to see people kind of try them out, to write about, the effect on their relationships, on their overall sense of hope, their sense of pleasure and meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been through this pandemic and we're still very deeply in it. And so your book is here at just the right time for so many people around the world who can't access you directly or have a conversation or come into your office or do a Zoom with you, but they can have your book and go through it step by step. And sometimes, that's even more helpful, right? To have it written down and to be able to process it and go through it at their own time and really feel zero judgment and all compassion that comes through the book.
And it acts like a menu of options. So let's say somebody really connects with the Humor and Lightness Week. That was a popular one in the program. Maybe you try a piece of the gratitude work, you try a piece of the strengths development and exploration, you try a piece of the kindness module, but it's really the lightness, playfulness, and humor module chapter that really resonates, then I encourage you to really focus on that. Make your own unique happiness toolkit out of these exercises. Maybe there's one or two, like the gratitude spot exercise is one of my favorites. And when I wake up in the morning, I sit and I immediately get in touch with gratefulness for another day, for my breathing, for basic human needs that are being met, and then allow that to expand into the rest of my morning experience. So whatever is going to work, the best fit is what I want people to take away from this book and from the program and from my voice and hearing a little bit about my experience.
And what I also think is amazing about this book is it's really not just for adults. There's no age limit on it, right? It can be for anybody, and we are all looking for happiness, or whether maybe some of us already have it, but it's the It's the goal for everyone, I think, right? Like, who doesn't want to be happy? Who dreams of being sad or uncomfortable or upset?
Yeah. And you know, it's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because many people see happiness as a destination. It's not really a place that you can arrive and say, well, I'm happy now and everything's fine. It really is a way of living, right? It's a way of being. So if we can automatically begin to just, wow, I'm moving it, shifting into my a grateful mode of thinking. Now I'm going to just touch base with my personal strengths, and I'm going to be mindful with this really stressful event that happened earlier on with with a colleague. So all of that gets, I hope, get integrated and absorbed into a lifestyle, a positive lifestyle where you're always nurturing, like you nurture a flower with soil, light, water, warmth. You're nurturing your best possible self as much as possible each day.
And so many of us can get caught up in, I will be happy when.
Yeah. When? Right? When I get
when
that
next. I have, when I get, when I do. And it's so common. I mean, we can't beat ourselves up over that either, right? Because we're living in a society where so many of us are doing that. And we just are, whether it's our conditioning or we learn from each other. And so it's really, I love that we are at a place in time right now where people are so open to this and really listening to their deeper selves, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
And like when you and I were in high school, college, like, was this the forefront of the conversation? Were our parents talking about this? I don't think so.
No, we can be, the point that we can be fulfilled in the here and now, right? That we don't have to wait to getting that next position at work or that, the new car or the new relationship or whatever it is that we've put on the pedestal in front of us, that a sense of completeness, a sense of well-being, a sense of transcending yourself, spiritual expansion can happen in the present moment. And isn't that liberating?
Yes. Yeah, it's so freeing. It's so like we have the power within ourselves, and it's our mindset and shifting and meditating and all of these great things that you bring to light in the book. So, so important. Such really great reminders.
And my, you mentioned, is this good for all ages? My son, who's 12, has asked if he can write the kids version of A Happier You. I said, absolutely, Zach, let's start working on that and how to translate this for elementary school students. Yeah. and making it, I'm so proud of him and the way he's embraced positive values in living. He's just, that's probably one of the greatest joys and the greatest meaning in my life is how he's becoming this wonderful young man with a great heart. And
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm almost in tears because it's true. And it's your work and your, deep dive into all of this. And he sees that, right? So you are this great example for your son, and how amazing that he fully understands these ideas and wants to write the kids' version. I love that. I also have a 12-year-old. So maybe our two kids can.
Yeah, they can get together. They can co-author.
That would be great. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And certainly better than video games, which he's, he's into as well. So anything to bring him into.
Getting her off of TikTok and Instagram. Right. I'll do anything.
Right. Just show me where to sign.
Yeah, anything else. Anything else. Yes. And co-authoring a book would be amazing. And what you really pointed out in this conversation is that in authoring the book, although you had been in practice and teaching and having a lot of clients and working with others, it sounds like writing the book really had you go just sit with yourself and realize, like, I can really practice this and let me be doing this every day. Because sometimes we just get so busy with work, right? And giving to others and doing the work helping others that we forget to do it for ourselves. So I love that the journey of the book really helped you to also work on it yourself and practice all of the things that you know, but sometimes life gets in the way.
Yeah, you know, so affirming. And that's why it's important to, first of all, self-care. You know, the people who help others in this world oftentimes put themselves last on the self-care agenda. And so I think this book can really help remind you that you are a priority as much as anybody else in your life. And in fact, if you can't carve out time for yourself, it's going to be a lot more difficult to be a great resource for your family, your friends, your coworkers, the other people that you care about and that you interact with on a daily basis. So we I think need more of that message, that permission.
To fill ourselves up. And you touched on the idea of relationships. And I think so many of us think of relationships as somebody else who will make us happy. Right. And as you said, we put relationships and so many other things on pedestals, but especially relationships. We're looking for that person who will make us happy and give us and do for us and whatever it is that we need from them. But it's all within ourselves. Right.
Yeah. It's very tempting to look for an external answer in somebody else or an explanation. Well, why am I not feeling good? It's maybe because what somebody else did or said, versus looking at how we're interpreting what they did or said. Is there another way of looking at that? Is there a way of shifting attention to some of the, if you're having difficulty with somebody, I talk about this in week 7, chapter 7 of the book, of expanding, widening the reach of your love for others that you've had some difficulty with. And that can be a very intentional practice of sending loving thoughts and feelings towards somebody, or appreciating aspects of somebody or aspects of a relationship that were positive, even though if it may have soured, bringing that back into the here and now. Because ultimately, what good does it do if we're constantly circulating resentment, right, you know, around, you know, something that happened? I think that's the responsibility that we take for our own internal lives, right, and what we need the tools to do that.
Yep. And the victim stories, right, that we create and then go out and share over and over. And how does that serve anybody?
And certainly that you need to process trauma. And when you're victimized, you know, it's not an overnight, it's not a light switch going on and then it's no longer bothering you, or it's no longer an issue in your life. Oftentimes being understanding that it's a repeated process, but you may want to set some limits on how absorbed you are with thinking about what happened or processing the negative feelings or the meanings or the thoughts. May get to a point where you might feel like, you know what, can I look for a different perspective right now? Or can I shift to placing my intention on something I want to grow more in my present life, present relationships, right, job.
And going back to that idea of being triggered by some people or seeing the negative in others, lately I've learned a lot about the fact that that's a mirror. And why are we triggered? And what is it within ourselves that's triggering us? And how can we help ourselves? What is that piece, right?
Yeah. And that piece may go back to, you know, this is my cognitive behavioral psychologist hat on here, looking at our core beliefs that we've developed that may not be serving us really well, or developed based on faulty assumptions that we've made about the world or about our experience. There are really three that you want to look out for: worthlessness, unlovability, and hopelessness. You know, that I'm not lovable, you know, I'm not worth anything, I'm incapable, and I don't see a good future. Those can be the core ideas that can circulate all of the interpretations and draw in the interpretations of what happens to us each day to say, oh, look, there's another example that they didn't accept me for that, you know, that position that I'm now unlovable. I knew I was. So here's the evidence to support that. I think the more you become aware that there are these underlying structures there, again, with a good therapist by your side, the more you don't have to respond to them in the same way. And the more you can build the alternate versions. I am lovable. I'm capable, I am worthwhile, and I have hope for the future. I believe in myself and my abilities that I'm going to be able to achieve what I want in my life.
Right. And you get to those points by having gratitude, right? And seeing what you're grateful for, what's within you that you can be grateful for. I did a challenge with a friend by text for 21 days, and we wrote 50 things that we loved about ourselves, and we just wrote it back and forth to each other. And it was incredible. Right? Because it doesn't take that much time and you can write anything, you know, but you put these limiting things on yourself. You put these rules on yourself, like, oh, but I already said that. I can't say that again. Well, but why not? And like, who's grading it? Right? But it's the practice of focusing on what you do love about yourself, because it's so easy, I think, for many or most of us to be so hard on ourselves. We come into the world doing that somehow.
We do. And, you know, we're our own worst critics. You know, we've heard that expression before. Writing down what we have to feel thankful for or what our good qualities are, and that can be one and the same, really reinforces it at a cognitive level, at a neurobiological level, at an emotional level. So that's why there's a lot of suggestions in Happier You to have a piece of paper by your side, to begin making these lists, to begin documenting all of your positive experiences, catching them in your net, and then expanding them with questions like, oh, what is that good? Does that mean about me? Or why do I feel so grateful for my lovely wife who's always been there for me? And how does that help me in terms of my confidence and how I'm going to feel next week or the week after, right? It's those internal questions based on what we're catching and spotlighting and doing that in an intentional way where we're more and more filled with everything that we do have versus the deficit side, right?
Right. Yes, absolutely. So, so good to be with you today, Scott.
Great to be with you as well.
Enjoyed this conversation. Look forward to our two 12-year-olds meeting up to co-author.
Yes, definitely.
Version and find all their happiness and just to share notes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And just great to see that experiences from your youth and the trauma that you suffered and some of the things that you went through really evolved into such a great passion and the way you support and love others, the book you brought into the world, and all that you are teaching and sharing with people. Thank you.
Julie, I'm so grateful for you and the opportunity to connect with you here and to share this conversation with your viewers and listeners, because it is an honor, I think, to be in a place where you can help others. And so that we have parallel missions in the world. So I look forward to chatting with you again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you to everyone for watching The Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose. Have a great day.
This podcast is brought to you by Winject Studios. We are an all-in-one educational platform for podcasters that revolutionizes how hosts leverage content to increase engagement with listeners, downloads, and income. We come together to focus on community, collaboration, and collective impact. For more information on how you can interact directly with our hosts, access exclusive live content with offers you can't get anywhere else from our official partners, join our purpose-driven community by visiting www.winject.com. If you're ready to build a career doing what you love, then we're ready to see you there.